Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club's week-to-week program, our news roundtable for Friday, May 17th. I'm so glad you came out to join us. Gorgeous weather. You flew against the wind, if you will, and you came inside. So thank you. I'm John Zipperer. I'm your host for today. As always in our program, we'll be talking about some important events and trends over the past week or two. Not that there's anything to talk about, right? Of course, any opinions we express are just those of us, and not necessarily those of the Commonwealth Club, its members, supporters, neighbors, people who drive by, anything like that. So let me introduce our panel, the people who will actually be making these comments. I'll start on the far end is C.W. Nevius, columnist at the San Francisco Chronicle. His Twitter handle is, and you'll never guess this, it's C.W. Nevius. The name is Nevius.
The Twitter handle is pronounced Nevius.
That was tricky. That's
kind of Twitter, everything's different.
The internet anonymity you went for, that was good. Next to him is Melissa Griffin. She's a columnist for the San Francisco Examiner, and she's also a contributor to KPIX-TV and San Francisco Magazine. And she's an attorney, so be careful what you say around her.
It's all confidential. Okay.
And she's on Twitter at SFEX_Griffin. And right next to me is Aaron Sankin, assistant editor here for the Huffington Post. And he's on Twitter at ASankin. So feel free to follow them all. There are question cards scattered around on the chairs. Please write down any questions you have. We'll dedicate part of the program later to answering them, but I'll also work some of them in our discussion here in the first part. And then, of course, at the end of the program, we'll have two contestants come up here for our news quiz, the first prize. There really is only one prize. So the winner will get a genuine bottle of two-buck Chuck. Two-and-a-half buck Chuck.
Which
I keep being reminded.
Which I'm all at home, by the way.
It's been red wine for the past couple times. This time we're going with Chardonnay, so we know our audience. But let's get into the news of the week, and I wanted to start off talking about Benghazi, or as the Republicans say, Benghazi, Benghazi, Benghazi. But it's an issue that has been around, obviously, since before the election. It didn't seem to have much impact on the election, but it's, if you will, flared up again. And then, mysteriously, it got pushed down the front pages by some other scandals. But before we get to those, I wanted to talk about Benghazi and get your sense of, is this a real scandal? Is this manufactured? What exactly is the issue that Obama and his team are or are not at fault for?
Well, we always find the same thing, which is that it's not really what happens, it's covering it up later. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the idea that to say after the fact that it was not a terrorist attack, this was a spontaneous demonstration, it somehow emerged out of Egypt, none of that turned out to be true. And that's always when it comes back to bite you. It must be difficult in a position like that not to try to adjust the narrative, but it's always a bad idea, and it's proved to be a bad idea here.
Well, it seems to me like the Republicans were looking for something. they were losing. The immigration reform wasn't happening. I mean, they were just getting beaten up. And I feel like they said, oh, well, here's this thing that's been lying around. Let's try to gin this back up. I think to some degree, when the IRS scandal broke, they were like, yay, a real one that we can actually get behind. And phew, because I don't know how long we had on the Benghazi thing. I got to be honest. And polls show that Americans don't feel misled. Polls show that Hillary Clinton has not, her popularity has not suffered at all. I mean, literally, it's actually gone up 3 points if you believe this, the public policy poll, that it seems to be pretty accurate, or historically has been pretty accurate. So it doesn't seem to me that story has been getting a whole lot of traction, although I have to give you one perspective. This is Barbara Boxer on the floor of the Senate. Mm-hmm. I had to bring this because this was her response, and she came out and in favor of Hillary Clinton and basically said, leave Hillary alone. This happened. This was May 14th. Okay. She says, I think the Benghazi scandal starts with the Republicans looking in the mirror. Mirror, mirror, who is the fairest of them all? They ought to ask, mirror, mirror, Who cut the funding for diplomatic security across this world for America? The answer, Republicans. So I think that it does bring up issues of government funding and, you know, sort of how far-reaching it needs to be and how much we should be spending overseas. But ultimately, I don't think this one has nearly the staying power or the traction or the implications for Democrats or even the Obama administration that some of these others have.
Aaron, we were talking earlier about this and whether Obama is actually now sitting around saying, oh, I wish they were talking about Benghazi again because it would take they wouldn't have to deal with some of the others. What's your take on it?
Well, I think it's interesting that if you're really comparing the kind of the way the administration and in I think an even more important sense, other elected Democrats across the country have reacted to Benghazi versus mm-hmm. reacted to the AP wiretapping scandal and the IRS scandal.
Yeah.
Where Benghazi, as you're looking at how they're reacting now, there's this pushback. As we've seen with Senator Boxer and we've seen with a lot of other Democrats where they're saying this is manufactured, this isn't real, this is the Republicans trying to damage Obama, this is the Republicans trying to damage Hillary for 2016. But when you compare that to, you know, how Democrats have reacted to these other scandals, which is just immediately getting as far back from those train tracks as possible, as fast as possible, where as soon as the IRS scandal broke, there were elected Democrats saying this shouldn't happen. And it's interesting that they're saying this is a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad thing. But at the same time, a lot of these Democrats, you know, during the election cycle were also really encouraging the IRS to say, you should really look at these Tea Party groups. You know, these groups are funneling a lot of money into the political system. We don't know where it's coming from or what are they're claiming to be, you know, out for social welfare. But does social welfare in this case particularly mean just helping the Republican Party?
So is this actually also, are you saying it's not a scandal because there's a story and there's a reason behind it? Or the IRS took something they should be doing, which is looking at all possible politically tinged groups, and they just went off the deep end on this? I mean, what do you think happened on this IRS?
I think there's some traction to this.
Sure.
I mean, the IRS thing sounds suspicious. That really does sound suspicious. And there's actually, Bob Woodward is now being asked, is it possible this could be something that could lead to impeachment? So now we're starting to use those words. And
they've been using that word January 8th, 2000.
But my point is there's been no reason to do it. I mean, I don't think they've had really anything. And somebody made an interesting point, which is it's not only the scandal trifecta, the AP, IRS, and Benghazi, but the other trifecta is obviously the Republicans have been looking for an issue forever. They wanted to have one. Some Democrats have not been that thrilled with Obama. He hasn't courted them. He hasn't reached out to them. They've sort of held up their end, but they probably had a little bit of a reason to it. And the media has been accused forever of being soft on Obama. And this is an opportunity for the media to say, hey, this is a big deal. We're even-handed. Look at this. We're going to treat this as seriously as we can. So it could be a perfect storm for Obama, who now is in a situation where this aloofness that we've heard about may play against him.
He or his administration did take some make some moves on the IRS. The acting commissioner, I believe, has been forced to resign, though I guess he'll still be in office till June.
Mm-hmm.
And I think someone else was kicked out. What do you evaluate that? Are those good preemptive moves to try to get on top of this, or is that, you know, throw some people to the wolves and not really deal with it?
Well, he was unrepentant today. I don't know if you saw his testimony today. Today he applauded the fact that they investigated these groups and said that the person who did the investigation was a valuable civic servant. So I don't know if that's how they wanted it to play, but he certainly did nothing to diminish the controversy.
Well, part of the problem with having these people resign is that they don't have any further reason to toe the party line, right? They can get up there and be like, I like that guy, and these groups are stupid anyway. So, I mean, you take away their any sorts of fealty that they have to the group. But somebody had to pay. And I think down the line, I mean, whoever, those people, those civil servants who were running those searches, ultimately they are, or they should be, subject to greater scrutiny and probably fired. I mean, I think that would be the only kind of thing that would help in this situation. Although with certain groups of people, there's nothing you can do, right? There's, you know, they've been waiting for this. They've been waiting for proof that the government is after them, and now we've served it right up. And as Democrats must be like, oh, seriously, why are you helping these people? You're just feeding into this crazy, you know, this nutty thought, you know, idea that the government cares about your $30,000 online, you know, freedom, whatever. And now it turns out that they were being targeted.
The next scandal is they're going to show that they actually are beaming messages through your tinfoil hat. So
yeah, if they bring in black helicopters, like, that's, you know, game over. Like, stop helping. So that's for Democrats. I think it's more of just, oh gosh. And I think, you know, after the Bush administration and the sort of the investigation into liberal groups under his administration, everybody sees that this is a problem. I think this is different from Benghazi, especially because this one you can say in 10 words or less. Part of the Benghazi situation is there's an old political maxim that if you're explaining, you're losing. And so trying to explain what is the scandal in Benghazi requires hopefully a knowledge of where that is, an understanding of, oh, so there was this raid and there were these talking points and it was supposed to be about a movie, but it wasn't. This other guy said that, you know, you can't explain it very quickly. And the IRS one is very simple and feeds into a paranoia that already exists. And that's why it's had a lot more traction. And that is why I don't know how many people, he would need to fire the entire department, frankly, to assuage the concerns of certain people. There's just nothing you can do to make people feel better to some degree. But yeah, some heads have to roll for sure.
Well, I think the issue when you're talking about this IRS scandal is that there's a kind of inaction on the part of Congress to really kind of figure out a way to competently regulate all of these, you know, 501c3, 501c4 groups. So that's essentially left it up to, like, essentially one team of government regulators in a facility in Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. So I think this was an attempt by the IRS, to really kind of deal with this situation and figure out how they're going to look at these groups. And they're going to say, okay, well, we have a feeling that groups that tend to have Tea Party in the name are probably going to be doing political activity. But I think one of the things that I saw actually this morning, which was fairly interesting, was that there's some speculation that the way that this scandal initially kind of broke into the public consciousness was a question that was asked of an IRS administrator. And it was asked by someone who was doing business, who was working really closely with the IRS, and there's some speculation that this question itself was planted. And it was a way for the IRS to start talking about this, start talking about something that they've been, you know, not entirely comfortable with.
Planted by?
Just someone in the IRS saying, we kind of want to start talking about this, and we're just going to ask this question in a public forum to kind of start talking about how this is working. And it seems like maybe to kind of test the waters. I'm pretty positive that there's no way they expected it to, you know, explode.
Sure.
But I think kind of the way that this scandal is really unfolded, mm-hmm. is that it's really a result of one group doing thing, the one group, the IRS, inside the executive branch, doing something that really should be coming from Congress.
And doesn't pass the smell test. And I think not to use a buzzword, but the transparency issue is the important thing.
Yeah.
If the IRS had said ahead of time, one of the things that we're doing is we're taking certain groups. If we had two groups, if we had a far left group and the Tea Party, we'd look a lot better. But what they've done is they've handed this aha moment to conservatives of, oh my God, we thought this was happening, now you're telling mm-hmm. us it does.
Well, and it basically puts as a bad guy here the group that conservatives probably could not hate more to begin with. And that kind of leads me to something I think Melissa touched on, or you touched on it with the FBI AP story, where the FBI it's come out that they had, did they go through the court to get the subpoenas of this information? They just went and got these internal communications from these Associated Press reporters, and they were trying to track down a leak. But like the IRS couldn't be held in any more contempt by conservatives and a lot of liberals, the press can't be held in much lower contempt by especially a lot of conservatives. So it's kind of a win-win if you're just a Republican kind of enjoying both Obama having a bad time and the IRS and the Associated Press.
But if you'd like to be sure you had something that had legs, it's always a good idea to attack the press, because the press would be happy to keep that alive. And you're thinking to yourself, they're going after my cell phone? And again, unrepentant. I mean, I think Eric Holder did not say, maybe we crossed a line here, maybe we should have been more careful with this, maybe we should have been more transparent. He said, you bet we did it. It was a matter of national security. We did it, and we'll do it again. And that And that's, again, yeah. one of those things that is a hot button.
And President Obama also came out and said, mm-hmm. I don't recall his exact words, but something effective. Yeah, I'm not apologizing.
Mm-hmm.
Good
mm-hmm.
for us.
Yeah, yeah.
Any other words on scandals? Do you know what the next scandal will be?
I just love that David Axelrod, who used to be the president's advisor, said the other day, I wouldn't want to be in the White House now.
I mean, if anything, I think this has created a kind of odd alliance between Republicans in the press, where you see, at least for the first time, that I've really noticed a lot of Republicans calling for journalist shield laws, which is not typically a Republican issue. But, you know, if you can do something to damage Obama.
Yeah. I think your enemy is my enemy.
Yeah.
Well, let's switch topics, and it would be harder to make a bigger switch than this. But here in the Bay Area, in San Francisco, we've been witnessing a lot of preliminaries and practice runs for the America's Cup, which, for those of you who are not billionaires, is a race on the water, these giant boats. Well, they had some tragedy recently. There was a death during one of the practices, as I understand it. And Chuck, you've been writing about this. What's your take on what's going on with this?
Well, just among us, okay, just talking among us, I think the America's Cup is in big trouble. We're running out of boats. The Italian team has a press conference today at 2:30. It's a very mysterious press conference. The head of the team has flown in from Italy, and they say they don't really have an announcement, but the Italian team only has one boat. So far, we've built 7 of these 72-foot, Melissa and I were talking about it. She can tell you a lot about it as well. They're 72 feet long. They have a 13-story sail. We had an editorial board meeting, and the guy who's in charge of the regatta said that they don't have a boat on the water that can keep up with one of these sailboats when it gets up on the hydrofoil and starts going. So the speeds are unbelievable. And frankly, what we're hearing is that some of the sailors, many of the sailors, are scared to death. These boats are incredibly powerful. They're incredibly fast. And now we know that they're incredibly dangerous and maybe deadly.
Now, is this a bigger size boat, or is this the normal boat they've been using? For
the original, the way that Larry Ellison won, the way that Oracle won mm-hmm. the America's Cup was in a trimaran. And that was a big change. Most of us remember the 12-meter yachts, which were single hull. They cruised along at 8 or 9 miles an hour, a lot of tactics. It was kind of like watching a slow-motion sprint. You know, you'd see them all kind of doing this. And the trimaran was a revelation. I mean, this thing took off like a shot. And I had a guy tell me this week that there's not a sailor who was on that boat who is sober who will tell you they were not scared to death in that boat. It's just too fast. It's just too powerful. It's just too dangerous. And I think this competition, we may have gone a ship too far. We may have overdone it. We may have designed. Technology is a wonderful thing, but at some point, you have to say, we can't just keep going faster and faster and faster. We have to think of the consequences. And I think that's what we're going to have to do.
Melissa, what do you think is going on with the American
Cup? You know, I couldn't agree more. I mean, it's definitely in trouble, and people are frightened. I mean, the man who died, I mean, the security measures that these guys have to take are pretty extraordinary. They have strapped to them a little oxygen tank that will provide several minutes of oxygen if you're trapped underwater like this man was. I just mean, even that was not enough to save him. He may have been knocked out, or he may just have been held underwater for too long, such that it wasn't, he couldn't avail himself of it, or it ran out. But it's hard to imagine the kind of extraordinary measures that you would have to take to allow these people to be safe. What Larry Ellison has done is, because he won on, so, you know, there's usually I'd say this because I'm from Georgia and I don't know much about yachts. So let me just explain. So this is the way I understand it is, you know, you sort of have the old school yachts, and when he says that, what is it called? The trimaran, there's multiple hulls on it, right? So there's 3-1, you know, the ones you see sometimes in like a Sunkist commercial, you know, where there's sort of a pole and then there's sort of 3 boats connected to it. He got really good at it. And so we thought, well, now that I won and I get to make the rules. By the way, that's how it works in this world. It's as if when the San Francisco Giants won the World Series, they were in charge of baseball and they could create all the rules that they want. It's like that. So Larry Ellison says, well, great. I get to make the rules now. New rule. All your boats have to be this long and half. They have to be of this type that, by the way, my people are already pretty good at. So he ends up with this sort of head start that some people say is unfair. At any rate, he definitely wants to make this a cutting edge thing. He wants it to be, less like a, state fair, race and more like the Indy 500, right? He wants to be technologically on the cutting edge, so he requires this boat to be used. And it, to your point, might have been biting off more than he can chew. It's part of the reason why we don't have more syndicates involved. It is super expensive to build. You have to have a crane just to put the mast on. They actually have to have one dude whose whole job is to sit and with a crane, which is not free, and put it onto the boat. I mean, that is how incredibly massive these things are. They look like my boyfriend's son went out there and just thought it was Star Wars. He said it looked like the spaceship. It's that huge. So, yes, people are scared. Yes, they may have bitten off more than they can chew. And it's not just that the people are scared. It's that it's expensive at a time when Europe is in a financial crisis and it is prohibiting more teams from wanting to participate. I think there's the junior Italian team has already said, no, we're not going to.
German.
There's a German team?
German team. Mm-hmm.
Said that they're not going to participate. So we're seeing people sort of pulling out of this for reasons that they come to when they're sober.
Aaron, this was supposed to be a big boon to San Francisco. We were, going to have this great welcome and all of these celebrations and such. It kind of has turned into something now where we're looking at the city possibly losing $14 million was the sum I heard, which out of the $7.4 billion the city spends every year is not a giant amount, but it's certainly different than bringing in money. What are you hearing? What
Well, I think that this accident kind of feeds into this narrative mm-hmm. that's come in. I think that's been there since the America's Cup was first coming into San Francisco, where I think that Larry Ellison brought the cup to San Francisco, mm-hmm. winning it, and I'm going to bring it here. This is my hometown. This is going to be great for the city. Everyone's going to welcome it. And I think one that might have been a little bit of a misreading of kind of the general tenor of San Francisco. And it's at least specifically when it comes to something like the America's Cup. And just in just kind of the perception of this is, this is a yacht race for billionaires. And it's not like the owners of the 49ers and the Warriors and the Giants are, average, your everyday working
right,
stiffs.
Right.
But at the same time, there's this, I think
those
there's...
are billionaires, though.
Yeah. So there's this perception that this is something that's coming in from the outside. This is something that was promised to the city that there's going to be I think they promised something. There's going to be 15 teams. It's going to be billions and billions of dollars and everything. There's going to be a giant, with all these waterfront deals, and it's going to redevelop the waterfront. And I think everything's really been scaled back. And I think that there's this kind of sense that among a lot of people in San Francisco that this is something that was kind of dropped in on high, on fiat from very powerful people and then sold to the city, sold to the Board of Supervisors, some of whom were very explicit, talking about how they feel they were played in the issue in approving it. And I think what this really does is create this feeling of San Francisco's somewhere between, of the average San Francisco citizen, somewhere between like apathy mm-hmm. or kind of feeling that this is not a San Francisco thing, as opposed to where other sporting events where take, for example, the 49ers, where there's this big push to get the 49ers to host the Super Bowl.
That's right.
Even though that's something that's not technically going to be happening in San Francisco, that's something that I think more San Franciscans are going to feel passionate about because it's something that's, something that's theirs. I mean, if the America's Cup is something that stays in San Francisco, and this is something that Larry's Oracle Racing team wins, which... from the sailing people
maybe
I've talked to.
Maybe the only one in the race.
Yeah, it might just be Larry racing himself.
I win.
Which I don't think he would be too sad about.
He'd do that.
Yeah. Right. I mean, you don't become a billionaire CEO without, minimizing your possible losses. I mean, if this is something that comes back to San Francisco again and again, I think there's a chance that San Franciscans will, adopt it and it'll be something that's, they'll like. But right now, I think there's a sense, and it's in no way universal. There are a lot of people who are very excited for the America's Cup, but there's a sense among a lot of people that
I'd say two
uneasiness.
Chuck? One is there was a press conference last week, and one of the reporters was from New Zealand. I mean, it's a global event. And what Ellison's theory was that he was going to put this in a contained body of water that we could all see the race from the shore. And up until now, these races have been way out in the ocean, and you have to watch them on TV. That's not a bad concept. That's a good idea. Mm-hmm. San Francisco fans are phenomenon fans. They show up when the event happens. If you expect us to spend 6 months banging the drums for the America's Cup, we're not doing it. But last summer, when the 45s raced, and we had big fleets of boats, people did show up, and it was kind of a cool event. Now, how much skin does the city have in this game for this year? How much pressure is there going to be that we have to stage this in September of this year? Because we're running out of boats. Melissa's right. Artemis, which is the Swedish team that lost the crewman, is really waffling. They are not at all sure they want to do this. If they drop out, we're down to two challengers. We've got New Zealand, and we've got Italy. And Italy's got one boat. If it breaks, this is over. And they had envisioned 50 days of challenger racing on the bay with a fleet of many teams. If they'd stuck with the 45s, they would have had it. Because mm-hmm. the 45s, a guy told me yesterday, he said, you and I could put together enough money to get a 45. And I hope he has a lot of money because I couldn't have done it. But the point is, those were reasonable. Those were reasonable. The 72s are a whole different thing. And we're not going to have the race that we thought we were going to have. If we lose Artemis, and who knows what the Italians say today, this whole thing could go sideways. And then how much pressure is there going to be to hold it anyhow? We're going to do it anyway.
I think they're going to have to. One thing that they could do, though, is to, and again, not a sailor, so pardon me if I mangle this, is to make it such that the boats don't go out if it's too windy. There, that's layman's terms. There are ways of measuring wind, of course, and at other times and in other races, they say, look, if it's too windy, we're just not going to let you go out. In this case, because it is supposed to be visible, because they've got these great contracts, I think, with NBC to cover it at, you know, the race starts at noon, so NBC coverage starts at noon. So they didn't want to monkey with that because otherwise, you know, you're just not going to be sure when the event's going to start, and for media purposes, that wasn't going to be tenable. But they may have to. That's just one idea of something they could do to try to make it more safe or more palatable for people. Like the America's Cup, it's like Brigadoon, right? It kind of shows up and kind of happens in various countries every 4-ish years, and then everyone goes away. What Larry Ellison, my understanding, is trying to do is create a league, is to create something to get behind. Is to create a team that you can follow, so it becomes more like the 49ers, where it's our guys, and I know who they are, and maybe Larry Ellison himself isn't like the most sympathetic person, but if he could come up with a team that people could root for and really get people engaged during the intervening years and have a place where the race could stay, and that prospect of that being San Francisco, we're going to build up the sailing infrastructure, we're going to build up these cameras and the media infrastructure and do it here, that is an incredible opportunity, and if the race doesn't happen this year, it's not clear that that'll ever get momentum. So I think that is the real push, in addition to all the other investments that we've made, to get it somehow workable so that people aren't deathly afraid and feel like they can go out and do it, and it may require, you know, some other safety measures to be put in place. But the abandoning that idea of a sailing league based, you know, a global sailing league based in San Francisco is I think going to be a tough thing to get over if they want to call off the race.
Well, I think to build on Melissa's point, I mean, I think for decades and decades and decades, you know, the race, it was held in New York, it was held in the same place, like one yacht club continually won. I think in moving away from that, and I think Larry's trying to build that in San Francisco, but I think in addition, he's trying to kind of turn sailing in America into a lot more of a spectator sport, like more of like a kind of like a NASCAR on the water, where I think it's really, you know, they're moving the boats closer.
And if there's any overlap between the NASCAR audience and 72-foot yachting races, I
think it might just be Larry. I think there's that that effort that was why they went and they got that TV deal, and that was a TV deal that was from what I understand, that was very generous to the television network to be like, we really want you to televise this.
Yeah.
They're kind of put the cameras. They want the cameras like really like covering the boats. They want microphones and stuff on the sailors, who, from what I understand, you know, sailors are
What do they curse? What do they curse like?
They curse like like fishermen. So I think it's this kind of larger effort that spearheaded this time by Larry this time, and I think by a lot of other people in sailing, to really just, we're going to bring this sport slowly but surely into the major leagues of other sports, at least in America. And I think it's debatable whether, I mean, all of that is, you know, riding on what goes on in San Francisco. Sure. And it's also kind of debatable whether that's something that's possible. But it would be interesting.
Well, we'll all see whether it's...
Actually, just one last thing. I've been told by people in the Oracle group that this is going to be the last year they're going to use boats of this size. That no matter what happens, this is the only year you're going to see this. If they do go forward, get on out there, because next year the boats will be small. They might not go back to the 45s, but they will make them smaller and easier. So.
A columnist in San Francisco recently suggested they use the 45s. That was me. Because they used them last year, and it seemed like that was effective. There is a quirk in the rules, I should point out, which is that the hulls of the boats have to be made in the country of origin. And the 45s that were used last summer were all made in New Zealand. So technically, they can't use the 40. If they want to just switch, and there's talk of doing that, just to switch to the 45s, let's just have the race with that. It would mean that they would have to change the rules, which can be done by mutual consent, but just so you know.
Very good. Well, let's move from talking about spending Larry Ellison's money to talking about taxpayer money, and specifically California. And California, for those of you who are watching the budget situation, we were a binge state. We're either flat broke, $72 billion in debt, or, oh, look at this, we have $20 billion more to spend. Aaron, you've been covering this. You wrote about it this week. What can you tell us about what's going on in Sacramento now that their numbers are coming in terms of revenue and the state economy that are better than they have been in a while?
So earlier this month, the governor released the annual May revision of the budget. So generally the way this works is in January they do a budget projection. This is, you know, how much money we think we're going to take in. And then in May, they come and they revise that. In January, they said, you know, we're going to have a big surplus. And then everyone was like, really? California? Okay. and then in May, in this new revision, they revised that down. They still think there's a surplus. They're cutting it down a good amount. There are a number of...
And I should ask, why did they explain why they thought it would be less?
Yeah, so some of the thought is that they're... is that possibly what had happened to create California being flush with money was something that was kind of a one-time thing. Okay. And so there are a number of arguments as to why this could have occurred, but one of them was essentially that at the beginning of this year, during the whole debt ceiling, fiscal cliff fight in Washington, there was some concern that there would be a hike in the federal taxes because the Bush tax cuts would sunset. It turned out that they only let that sunset for people with very, very high incomes.
Right.
But in California, a lot of those people are like, I don't want to have to pay more taxes. I'm going to sell a lot of my assets now. So they sell all these. So their thought is that a lot of people sell assets. And then at the same time, California passes Prop 30, which was retroactive for all of income in 2012. So any of those assets that you sold, they're going to be taxed at California's higher tax rate for people at the higher income levels. Mm-hmm. And this is also, but these are also people who are doing this to kind of avoid federal taxes. So it kind of creates this perfect storm of a lot of people being like, I'm selling a lot of this stock.
Right.
And then the state's getting more money and the state's taxing this to people who have a lot of money, for people who have a lot of money at a higher rate. So there was some fear that maybe this was a one-time thing. There was also some of the people in Jerry's budget office were like, you know, the sequester could possibly slow the economy. And in California, a state where the vast majority of our revenue comes from personal income taxes, that can be, you know, that can be very inconsistent. I was speaking the other day to Larry Gersten, who's a frequent panelist here, and I was asking him about this, and he was like, you know, California has a very long history of saying that we're going to have budget surpluses and saying things are going to do really well at the beginning of the year, and then when it comes to the end of the year, it was like, whoops, where did all that go? So I think there are a lot of factors that, but Jerry's budget analysts, like including the sequester possibly slowing down the economy, that there are a lot of factors, and they're like, maybe this is not as much as we thought, and because of that, maybe everyone in the a lot of the Democrats in the legislature are looking at the surplus to be like, hey, we've really shredded our social safety net. Maybe we could give a lot. Maybe, you know, we could spend some money. You know, maybe we could even
backfill some of these programs.
Maybe we could give some money to our courts. Who, you know, Melissa, you're a lawyer. You've seen what's happened to the courts in recent years as these.
Would you like some of that money, Melissa?
I would. Yeah. I'm going to put my even courts now. I mean, they have yesterday I was in court and we were trying to schedule a subsequent hearing and the judge said, "Well, no, we can't do it on that day because we only have court reporters every other day now." Oh my God. But according to Jerry Brown, next year's budget has the same amount as this year's budget for the courts. They're not getting cut. They're just not going to get any money. Mm. And when he was asked specifically, "Are you going to use any money to backfill these social welfare programs?" He gave the answer, no.
Aaron quoted the governor as saying, "Everybody wants to see more spending. That's what this place is. It's a big spending machine, but I'm the backstop."
You know, Obama said this week that he would like to go Bullworth.
Yes.
If you saw that. You remember that movie?
Explain what that means.
Warren Beatty was in a movie, and he, as a character, he had a little mental lapse. And he was a politician. He began saying exactly what he thought, rather than what the political thing was. And it was a hilarious, in its own way, movie. But Jerry Brown's a little bit of that Bullworth, you know? He's not running for another office. And you got to love him just saying, you know, whatever comes to his mind. And that he said, no, we're not going to do that. He's got this idea for schools where we're going to give much more money to schools, which is a great idea. But he's going to turn more money over to certain schools, non-English-speaking schools that are not lower-achieving schools. There's a little concern that he's kind of giving them the money and telling them to do what they will with it. But that's his idea. He's going to do it. So it's an interesting dynamic. It's a fun time to be covering politics in California, I would think.
Yeah. So basically everyone in Sacramento, except for Jerry Brown, is coming up with new ideas for spending this money we may not really have.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say everyone. There are still Republicans.
Okay.
I mean, they're large.
Name four of them.
can I punt on that one?
Yeah, you can get back to me on that one. Well, I want to move to a topic that sounds very local because it's the matter of bicyclists versus cars, if you will, and how cities plan for these things. These things really affect certain, especially on a very local level. But the whole issue of redesigning streetscapes, of incentivizing different transportation uses, I mean, this is a national thing. And we're seeing this in more cities than just San Francisco and the Bay Area. But the Bay Area, of course, as the Bay Area does, takes this very much to heart. Currently in San Francisco, I know on Polk Street, if you all know that street, strongly commercial street, surrounded by lots of residential as well, the SFMTA, which has basically the power of God to deal with this, you know, the transportation and the street issues in the city, is talking about potentially removing the high end. There was possibly 200 parking spaces along this stretch of the street. This brought a number of the businesses, the retailers along that area, basically made them apoplectic because they were like, well, how, you know, X number of my people come here by car. There are going to be fewer places. There are bicycle advocates in the city who are saying this is one of the most dangerous streets for bicyclists. I don't know if it's the first or it's very near the top, at least, in terms of the number of bicyclists who are hit, who are injured or worse. So let's talk for a little bit, if you will, about, I mean, the city's making priorities. What's driving a lot of this on the SFMTA's position is obviously this environmentalism to try to encourage people to use transportation other than, you know, a private vehicle, therefore encouraging bicycles. That's what they want to do on, for example, on Polk Street. You're seeing this on other streets, however. And part of the reason I wanted to bring this up was because here I am talking about Polk Street. That sounds very narrow, but you're finding these coalitions of, like, local folks on both sides of this issue there who now are building coalitions with other neighborhood groups across the city who are facing similar plans. So any thoughts? I'm going to start with you, Chuck. How is the city doing this, and how should they be handling this kind of prioritization?
Well, first of all, it's a great topic because every time I write about it, I get hundreds of emails. So I know it's a hot topic.
Very polite ones, I'm sure.
I had it, very polite. All of them are very polite. who hasn't been yelled at by a bicyclist? I mean, we all just happened to me the other day. But 2 nights ago, I was on the Ride of Silence, so I rode a 12-mile route around to the 10 different places where bicyclists had been killed at intersections. The SFMTA says that since 2006, the number of bicycle riders has gone up 71%. Injuries have gone up 84%. Bicyclists are everywhere. There's a new bike shop, it's about 2 years old, on Market Street, Huckleberry Bikes. They began doing a census, and in the mornings during rush hour, they went out and counted the bikes going by on Market Street, which has definitely become an east-west corridor. They're counting up to 1,000 bikes an hour on Market Street. Now, Market Street has a dedicated bike lane, and I can't tell you, when we went on our ride the other night, how much more relaxed I was to be in a dedicated bike lane than to be on the street trying to share it with cars. Polk Street, however, is too narrow. There's not enough room for two bike lanes, two lines of cars, and any parking whatsoever. So something's going to have to give. And that's the issue right there. And it's just going to be very difficult and get more difficult in San Francisco.
I haven't been able to hear. I haven't heard any data, though. I understand why the merchants are upset. I actually live right near Polk Street, and the Middle Polk Neighborhood Association is a great organization I'm familiar with. And I know that they're upset. And whenever we do, you know, whenever we have this come up, the local merchants say, "What are you doing? You're going to kill our business." But it seems like so far that's based on speculation. I haven't seen any studies, any real studies. And for the SFMTA, I mean, I think one really useful thing they could contribute to this debate is to actually provide some data about what taking away these parking spaces actually means for the local community. I mean, I think people understandably freak out and say fewer people are going to come here. And then the bicyclists say that we've got our own data and we think that this will increase patronage of your locations. So everyone's sort of fighting, and there doesn't seem to be a set of information or set of numbers that everyone can agree is from an objective organization that's accurate. And I think without that, then everyone's just sort of, you know, punching the air. It doesn't really. It's difficult to get the two sides to negotiate on any of it because no one really understands what the impacts are.
Just real quick, I'll let Aaron talk. There is a study that says that 80% of the businesses are frequented by people who walk or ride a bike. Mm-hmm. But and the merchants even agree with that. They're complaining about the 20% they're going to lose. Mm-hmm. To which someone replied, "I've never driven up Polk Street and found a parking place in my life, so why would this be any different?" So anyway, that's
Aaron.
Okay, so. First, small caveat here. I'll make an admission. I'm a biker. I biked here. My bike is still hopefully parked out front. So I think the issue of Polk Street is one that's a little tricky. If you look at the actual data for the most dangerous intersections for bike accidents, off the top of my head, you don't see a lot of the ones on Polk Street on there. You see a lot of ones on Market. You especially see a lot of ones on Valencia. Both of those have dedicated bike lanes, but I think that's mainly a factor of just there being a lot more traffic. I think the issue when it comes to Polk Street is that if you're going from kind of the Marina or Cow Hollow to the southern part of the city, mm-hmm. Polk Street is really your best, most direct way of getting there on a bike. Because it's, you know, they call it Polk Gulch for a reason. It's like the lowest, easiest point. Yeah. If you wanted to get there from another direction, you'd have to essentially go all the way around Fort Mason, all the way around Fisherman's Wharf. It takes a lot more time. And just in my experience with bicyclists, you know, as long as there's not a giant hill, that's probably the way you're going to go. And I think Polk Street, even though it may not be the most explicitly dangerous, it's if you ride down Polk Street, it's really scary and it's really hectic. I mean, maybe last year I was riding bikes down Polk Street with my wife, and she was hit by a car there. It ended up not being more than, you know, cuts and, you know, a few scrapes. Yeah. But I think what Polk Street does in its current form is it really cuts off a lot of people, especially people who live in the Marina, live in Cow Hollow, and would consider, you know, biking as their daily commute. It kind of cuts them off from the rest of the city on just a sheer comfort level of just being like, I don't want to bike down Polk Street because I did it once and I thought I was going to die for the entirety of my ride. So I think what that having Polk Street in its current form is one of those kind of bottlenecks, I think, that's really cutting off a lot of people from feeling comfortable on bikes and feeling comfortable biking around the city.
So you think that was the reason that street was
so? I think that's a reason. Mm-hmm. That's a reason why SFMTA is really targeting that specific area. And if you look at other areas that they're targeting now, like the Fell and Oak bikeways, they'd recently striped one of them, I believe it's Fell.
By striped, you mean?
They created a dedicated bike lane for a few blocks from the Panhandle going down towards the Wiggle. And I rode that for the first time a couple days ago, really conscious of it. And I remember being like, I'm in my own bike lane now. This used to be a very terrifying part of my ride because you're going down a hill with cars going 35 miles an hour. It was really scary. But then when you have your own dedicated lane, it's not scary. You don't feel threatened by the cars. So I think that even just having that particular dedicated lane for that small span of a few blocks is going to really make a difference to people who would consider biking, and using that to be their daily ride every day, but then wouldn't just based on pure comfort.
And one of the things I think also is that maybe SFMTA could encourage is Polk is not your best option as a driver to go east-west. You're much better to go across Van Ness and go Franklin to go back to the bay or go Gough to come back this way. And one suggestion, and a good one, I think, is to encourage drivers to get off Polk and get over to a place where they can. It's a one-way street. It's a good option for cars who don't care as much about incline. So there's probably a way to do it, but it's going to be tough to put two dedicated bike lanes onto Polk Street just because it's so narrow.
So for those of you who don't bike or drive or walk in San Francisco, everyone who's listening to this podcast and Kentucky, just go to Google Maps and, you know, you can visualize what this all is all about. Well, let's go through some questions from the audience here. And this is a different transportation question, but certainly one we have been hearing a lot about. Do you think we'll ever be able to drive on the Bay Bridge? Where should the buck stop? Melissa.
Oh, such a good question. What a fiasco. Bay Bridge. Well, what's tough, and I was talking to someone at Caltrans the other day about this issue, and what they said was look, the one right now is terrible. It's not seismically safe. I mean, the reason why we're building a second one is because this one is such a mess. And I was like, wait, is this your sale? This is your we're less likely to collapse into the water than the old one? Is that's what we're paying for? Okie dokie. It's really frightening. And I watched the state Senate Housing and Transportation Committee just had its very first hearing about this issue, and they bring in the Caltrans people. And I don't know if you guys recall this, but Caltrans, because when Caltrans, what have you? When they first were building the bridge, they were taking way too long. The bridge is six times more expensive than it was originally budgeted for. And so Governor Schwarzenegger took it away from Caltrans and gave it to the MTC and said, you guys deal with it because Caltrans are a mess. So they bring the Caltrans people in, they bring the MTC people in to talk about the bolts. And again, when you talk about if you're explaining, you're losing. Holy cow, like no one could understand what these people were saying. And it doesn't appear that we're going to get very far in terms of figuring out who should be fired and figuring out where this happened and who should be responsible for this. Moreover, going forward, I used to be an attorney for Bechtel Corporation. I worked there for a couple of years. And while I was there, they had it was when we were dealing with the Big Dig situation. I can tell you, like, if you go forward in this case, no matter what it is, it doesn't matter if it's a big butterfly that hits your windshield and you drive off the side and somebody dies, this issue is going to be in court again. I mean, regardless of how far afield it is, any plaintiff is going to take any injury from the bridge and try to tie it back to this. This is going to be an extremely expensive thing moving forward, even if they do put, like, they're proposing to, like, put a saddle. I don't know if you guys have heard the saddle solution. Like, put saddles over the bolts and what? It's supposed to make us all feel better. Again, ultimately, I think, you know, as sad as it is, it's going to have to be used because the one that we have now is again, crappier. So we got to use. We're probably going to have to use this one. It is probably going to open on schedule. I'm told that the fundraising has been done. The you know, it's like a wedding. You know, the invitations have been ordered. You're not backing out now. You know, your aunt's flying in. There's nothing you can do. So I think that they're going to move forward with it, but they're going to have to, you know, be very careful about how much traffic they allow onto it until they can all feel very comfortable. I know, it's crazy. Until they can feel really comfortable about driving across. I know, at least personally, I know one person who was going to move out of the city, like people do, and he specifically moved to the North Bay because he's like, I'm not doing that every single day of my life. I'm too scared. So I don't know what the impact is going to be on Oakland for the exodus over there, but yeah. there might be one.
It does sound like the safer way of traveling will be a 72-foot boat.
I was going to say, that would be a good
option. It'll definitely be faster.
it's very quick, very quick.
Well, one asks, going back to the IRS overreach issue and the problem, says, how much slack can we cut the lower-level people at the IRS inundated with requests for exemption? I mean, if they're talking about someone being fired, John Boehner wants someone to go to jail.
Well, this is pretty much the job description of the IRS. This is what they're supposed to do. And again, they have to be transparent and make us believe that they're doing a good job. But no one, as you said, no organization are we more suspicious of than the IRS. And they have to do all they can to make it look as if they're doing everything in the up and up. And this doesn't pass the smell test. It doesn't, no matter who it was. If it was the IRA, if it was the American Democratic Socialistic Committee, whoever it is, that doesn't look good to target them in that manner. So that's their job. They should be held accountable. And, yeah, heads will roll.
Well, Miller, when he was testifying, said
Stephen Miller, the
said that
Miller,
yeah, the dearly departed, said that he said that what happened was that people were just being lazy, that they were trying to figure out what groups might actually be crossing that line, that funky line that they've been charged with holding. And I have to be honest, just as a member of the public, if you tell me that there's a grand conspiracy or that people are lazy in government, I'm more likely to believe the lazy theory than the grand vast conspiracy leading to impeachment theory. But that's just me. Maybe I'm naive. But it seems to me that they were trying to cut a corner. To Chuck's point, I mean, this is their very job. But I tend to believe that it's less likely someone having it in for these groups than just trying to sort of find a way to get at groups that are more likely to be political.
You probably think the moon landing actually happened too, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, I have to kind of agree with Melissa's point, because it's also there are Democratic groups that were subject to the same scrutiny. There are a number of Democratic groups that were working in Texas and part of this grand Sisyphean effort to turn Texas blue. But I think it's like those groups were also targeted. And I think another kind of to add credence to the point, like from what I understand, none of these groups were ultimately denied their nonprofit status. I think what is happening is that they were like, well, you know, Tea Party, Patriot, you know, these words connote very specific things in a political context. And that means you throw them on this pile versus throwing them on that pile. And it did, you know, it drew, and it also being the IRS and being the government, it drew the process out for a very long time and made kind of their lives a lot more difficult.
They probably made some money for some attorneys, so you can't be unsympathetic.
We need it.
Okay. Well, someone writes, and they put a note on their card that, I am both an avid sailor and a cyclist, so they picked the right day to come to this program. If they work for the IRS, it's a trifecta. But anyway, they ask, what would be the comparison between banning these large, super fast boats in the America's Cup due to safety and what they're calling a sponsored sense of entitlement provided to cyclists? Sorry, Aaron. In a city where cyclists run red lights and punch cars, should we not be tougher on cyclists? Do they?
Well, I actually think that there was some actions that were going on recently by SFMTA or by SFPD, rather, where they were, you know, ticketing more cyclists for running red lights and specific places. I will admit, I got a very stern lecture from a police officer for running one of those pedestrians.
We have a reformed
panelist. And let me tell you, I have not run a red light on Market Street since. And I think this is doing a very specific thing. And it kind of reminds me of, there's a podcast. It's based out of San Francisco. They did a really interesting episode. They're called 99% Invisible. They do like transit urban design stuff. Yeah. And they were talking about the origination of the idea of jaywalking, where in the early 1900s there wasn't really a common sense in the United States that the streets were for cars, sidewalks are for people. So people would walk into the street and get hit by cars. So a lot of auto dealers and auto manufacturers got together and they created this concept of jaywalking, which wasn't an idea before. And they created the word as well. And at the time, jay was a fairly offensive term for yokel or a country bumpkin type person. And the idea was you were jaywalking if you came in from the country and came into the city and you were so flabbergasted and dumbfounded by the buildings that you walked into the street. So the way they worked with all these police departments to be like, okay, we want you to start, you know, telling people they shouldn't be jaywalking. And we want you to do it in a way that's not really giving them a lot of tickets. Mm-hmm. But we want you to just embarrass them, really. To be like, turn like someone who is a jaywalker into an insult. And they kind of successfully did that. And I think there's something slightly tweaked, something that I think SFPD was working on doing with cyclists. And of just being like, here are the rules. You should obey the rules. I mean, for a long time, the reason that cyclists were running red lights and stop signs is that, one, it's if there's no cars coming, it's easier to do that than, like, take out your toe clip and, like, stop. And also, there wasn't enforcement. Yeah. So I think by increasing enforcement, I feel like I've noticed an increase in the number of cyclists who are stopping for red lights. And then you can also see groups like the Bike Coalition going out and being like, I'm going to give little pieces of candy on Market Street to everyone all the cyclists that stop before the crosswalk
and
don't stop in the
crosswalk. What about the proposal to require bicyclists to be certified or get a license somehow, showing that they've been through safety training and traffic training and understand the rules?
Let's take a poll. Who thinks they should do that for bicyclists? Raise your hand. Who thinks that would be a bad idea? What do you think, Aaron?
It's one that gets kicked around every couple
yeah,
of years.
It we does. Consider.
I mean, it's an interesting idea. I think one of the reasons why, on one hand, it's a little bit of a false comparison to be like someone on like a 30-pound bicycle versus someone on like a 4,000-pound car. But at the same time, I think it's something that could be looked at. But one of the main arguments that bike advocates really are pushing for is they're saying we think that this is there's bikes versus cars is in the abstract away from any kind of like safety concerns in some kind of ideal world. If we could get everyone to get along and we got all the infrastructure perfectly right, we would much prefer having more people, as many people as possible, as would be convenient for them to ride bikes just because there's less traffic on the road, for the environmental reasons, for the health reasons. And I think there's an effort by the bike community to make that barrier to entry on a bicycle as low as possible, even just to like take some of the pressure off Muni, where if you get someone to bike and bike all the time, that's one less person who's on Muni.
Well, I wasn't thinking about Muni. I was thinking if there are fewer people driving over the bridge, it's less likely to fall. So they should have a
Well, I mean,
they're,
putting
a,
they're also putting a bike lane on the bridge.
Well, there you go. We've solved that one. Well, those of you who are listening to us online, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's week-to-week political roundtable. Our guests today are Aaron Sankin, Melissa Griffin, and C.W. Nevius. What we want to do now is bring up two folks to take our news quiz. And so if we could have a couple volunteers who have never done the test before, the quiz, young lady, please come up. And could we have someone else? You, sir. Why don't you, so we'll go ladies first. Okay. Truly, is that your first name?
Yes, Truly, like yours truly.
Yours truly, okay. We'll do her first and then you, sir. I'm going to ask five questions, then I'm going to ask him five questions. And whoever has the most will win our incredibly expensive prize. And whoever loses will have the good warm feeling of having competed for their country in this great contest. I'm going to sit down so I'm not towering over you like Zeus or something. Okay, first question. What news organization was itself the center of a news story after it was revealed that the FBI had snooped on it?
The AP.
That's correct. What international soccer star announced his retirement finally?
David Beckham.
That's correct.
What actress revealed this week that she had had a double mastectomy after she learned she had a very high likelihood of breast cancer?
Angelina Jolie.
3 for 3 so far. What country is Benghazi in?
Egypt.
Sorry, no. It's in Libya. What local organization, what local transportation organization or service is beginning major labor negotiations?
The BART.
That's correct. Okay. You got 4 out of 5.
I read that.
Stay up here. Yes. Well, Robert, you're going to be just as good. I'm sorry. Okay. I could ask the same one, see how you do. What country is... No. Okay. So yesterday, President Obama said he makes no apologies for what? What scandal is he not apologizing for?
Oh,
Benghazi. No, actually, he was talking about the AP scandal. He's basically saying, yep, we did it. We'll do it again. Let's see. Oh, okay. What did the U.S. House of Representatives do on Thursday for the 38th time? I'll give you a hint, it was a vote they took. What did they vote on for the 38th time?
Obama.
Want to take a guess?
Try to repeal Obama.
It's something they hate. No, they voted to repeal Obamacare. Yeah, that doesn't seem to be working out too well for them. Okay. Last night, the Golden State Warriors' season ended after they were defeated by what team in Game 6? That's correct. We keep manual score here, just like the old days. Nope, you've still got... How many have we done? Is that your third question? Okay. You have 2 more chances to tie it up. And if you do tie, then we do a tiebreaker. The excitement will not be able to be contained. Okay. A bipartisan group of Washington senators and congresspeople have banded together to address what problem in the military? It's been in the news lately.
Sexual assault.
That's right. Okay, this is it. With this final question, you could tie, send us into overtime, or hand the game to her. So, a painting, let's just say it's, quote, indiscreet, unquote, a painting of what late actress just sold this week for $1.9 million?
I love this.
Do you want to take a guess? No. Okay. It was B. Arthur. Well, thank you for competing, sir. But Truly is our winner today. Let me give you your prize. Treasure it always. That's right. Everybody, thank you so much for coming, and thank you to our panel, C.W. Nevius, Melissa Griffin, and Aaron Sankin. Please join us out in the library now for some refreshments. Have a great weekend.